again engaged in the heartbreaking process of learning that unless he turns to spiritual things, he suffers another devastating blow from nature's automatic compensating mechanism. For if the material things he creates are not used for the benefit of man, soon they become weapons that are turned against him. They separate, divide, and destroy until he is once more upon his knees begging for some sort of guidance. Unfortunately, it would seem that only circumstances can force man to do what his heart and conscience should have prompted him to do long before. The processes of wealth production, using the tremendous resources at our command, could easily maintain a generous standard of living for all men on the planet. But unfortunately, these processes of wealth production are still mainly looked upon as money-making processes rather than welfare-assuring processes. We are still more interested in the profit than in the patient. The limited and jealously guarded allegiances to different flags, complexions, and prayers have kept man from attaining a united, cooperative, organic whole. In a family unit where love is the ruling factor, we make whatever sacrifices are necessary to maintain the unity and welfare of the group. But the human family, created by one God, living in one home, the planet, is sadly lacking in a universal love that can bind it together. It is crying for a world conscience that can become the basis of cooperative living. It is the hope of the Baha'i world faith that all religions will at last link together their efforts in establishing this world conscience based upon the universal truths that are common to all their beliefs. Mankind has allowed historic accidents to divide it, accidents of national boundaries, of skin colors, of political theories, of religious beliefs. These differences, which should be factors of pleasing variety, have become weapons of separation. These so-called differences can play a vital part in the growth of society. They have validity and truth as long as they are recognized as relative and temporary stages of man's development. However, we have allowed them to crystallize into truths of permanent value. Until now, they have become barriers across which the concepts of world unity find difficulty in flowing. It is an unfortunate fact that the liberals of one age become the orthodox of the next. We gain our destination, our goal, and then we turn a well-directed cannon upon those who would come after us and go yet further. Scientifically, technically, we are a united world, an adult world. Emotionally, spiritually, we are an immature world, fighting over our dolls and our cherished inheritances. What an unhappy sight that there should be universal acceptance of those material scientific things that can dismember us, and no universal acceptance or recognition of the one thing that could preserve and unify us, love. It is just such a love that is missing from our united international undertakings today, a universal love. Not a vague and pious thing, but a wholesome, practical, down-to-earth realization that the world is one country and mankind its citizens. An insistence upon the obvious truth that there is no exclusive salvation for the Frenchman, the American, the Spaniard, nor any exclusive salvation for the Jew, the Christian, the Mohammedan, or the Baha'i. Any plan that is less than planetary in its scope is doomed to failure. The words of John Donne are truer today than ever. Do not send to ask for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for you. There is a new spirit abroad in the world that is booming out a requiem to those atrophied ideas which look only upon the advantages of the individual and which stunt and thwart the advantages of the community of man. It sounds a death knell to a society which, we are told, can spend $3.5 million more for liquor, $2.5 million more for cosmetics in 1 year than it can spend for education. It tolls out the last rites to an age that can deliver streamlined cars in abundance when housing is at a premium, that can live affluent in wines and liquors when large portions of the population are impoverished for milk. The world toward which man is striving is one in which there will be both streamlined cars and ample housing. A world where there will be a harmonization between capital and labor to the advantage of both. A world with more money for books and microscopes. A world where the extremes of wealth and poverty will be abolished, yet a world where there will always be varying degrees of success based upon talent and initiative. Above all, a world in which a man can enjoy all the fine things of life extracting all the throbbing wonder, adventure, and joy out of living because of one thing. Why? Because he has not allowed material advantage and individual gain to come between him and his responsibility to his fellow man and to his God. Such a world could be a reality today if a man desired it. He has only to put into effect the law of love. This means a return to a wholehearted belief in God. This is the purpose of true religion. This is the challenge to all faiths, that they rekindle their lost fire. Baha'u'llah, founder of the Baha'i world faith, has said, "The corrosion of ungodliness is eating into the vitals of a despairing society, and nothing but a fresh outpouring of its healing power can ever revive it." No one loves us, really. Our wives, husbands, our children, our parents, no one. They love the qualities that we possess, the kindness, the justice, the generosity. These are the things they love. And as we add these qualities to our lives, their love for us increases. And if we lose them, their love withers and falls away. And what is true of individuals is also true of nations. Unless a man reflects a love for all mankind in his heart, unless a nation pledges itself to the protection and welfare of all society, then neither can command the respect, devotion, or allegiance of those they might hope to lead. When Baha'u'llah wrote, "This handful of dust, the earth is one home, let it be in unity," he counseled that a man's glory should not lie in this that he loves his country alone, but rather in this that he loves his kind. These qualities which attract others to us and qualify an individual or nation for leadership can only be instilled in men's hearts by the law of love. This is not a foggy, ambiguous thing, this law of love. It is the only unifying force in the world. It holds the planets in their orbits, gives them order and harmony, holds our bodies together. In this form, we call the law of love atomic attraction or affinity. All creation operates by this law. It is the same law of love, affection for a common ideal that built our great nation, that built yours and the rest about the world. It holds clubs together, societies, nations, religions. Jesus said, "This is my commandment unto you, that ye love one another, even as I love you." When this love begins to wane, in whatever field it may be operating, it brings about the dissolution and death of the organism, whether it is the mineral, the animal, or the human kingdom, whether it is physical, social, or moral. When the law of love, atomic affinity, or common aspiration begins to lose its vitality, the organism disintegrates and dies. It is this law of love that is missing from the life of society today. No finer expression of the law of love can be found than in the Mosaic Code. There you will find provision as well as pity for the poor and the needy. The laws regarding the widow, the stranger, the orphan show a deep humanitarian spirit. This consideration for mankind rises to a remarkable height in the so-called Holiness Code of Leviticus, where there is a consideration for strangers and aliens that existed nowhere in the ancient world. The law of love shines constantly from the words of Christ. Baha'u'llah, founder of the Baha'i world faith, has again breathed into the world this law of love. It lives throughout the more than 100 volumes which he wrote. He has written, "Know thou that in every age, all divine ordinances are changed and transformed according to the requirement of the time, except the law of love, which like a fountain always flows and is never overtaken by change." What is it that has enforced these laws as given by the world educators, such as a Moses, a Jesus, a Buddha, a Muhammad, or a Baha'u'llah? What has made it possible for a civilization to rise upon their teachings? Without question, it was the belief of the Hebrews that the Mosaic Code had a divine origin, that it was not man-made. This was the source of its vitality. "Thus saith the Lord," was the authority. In Jesus' time it was, "This is not from me, but from my Father which is in heaven." Another way of saying, "Thus saith the Lord." Baha'u'llah has in like manner emphasized that if spiritual truth hopes to exercise any abiding influence upon the affairs of men, it must have an authority to which men can lay down their lesser allegiances of the superiority of race, class, or country to a world allegiance. No force, says Baha'u'llah, no power can restore and stabilize the world's prosperity today but the awakening of man to a sense of the oneness of all the world in all of its social relationships. This means that he must eliminate all his prejudices of skin, flag, and prayer. And this can be brought about, Baha'u'llah tells us, by no other agency than a return to a belief in God. It must be a God far beyond the limited concepts of an unthinking world, not a God who commands, who points a finger, and who says, do this, do that, but an unknowable God beyond definition or description, a God infinite who works through channels called world educators, prophets, a Moses, a Jesus, a Buddha, a Muhammad, a Zoroaster, a Baha'u'llah, great spiritual leaders who call mankind's attention to the laws of God for the age in which he appears. Whether a man obeys or rejects these laws remains his own responsibility. He is not given a peremptory order. He is given an opportunity, and the choice is his. Just as all our knowledge of material things is widened in this age, so has our understanding of spiritual truth. There can be no blind acceptance in such an enlightened age as this. God's greatest gift to mankind, says Baha'u'llah, is his intelligence. Religion and science must go hand in hand, and any religion which is contrary to science is merely superstition. A religious education which is fitted to this age means a belief that there is in reality only one religion, and that all the great prophets have taught one and the same thing. It is one law of love flowing through them all. In Moses we see the seed, in Christ the bud, in Muhammad the flower, and in Baha'u'llah the fruit. All are equal, all are valid. They are separate stages in the development of man's understanding of the law of love as applied to the age in which he is living. It is not necessary to lower Jesus to raise Baha'u'llah, nor to lower Moses to raise Jesus, for their missions are one, their teachings inseparable. All have called mankind to the same truth, that lovers of mankind, these are the superior people of whatever country, belief, or complexion they may be. Men who have dedicated themselves to the service of society will find Baha'is in over 110 of the major countries of the earth waiting to spring to their assistance. Today, in over 2,500 localities of the world, there are Baha'is of every background. Background of race, of faith, of nation, of economic strata, linking their efforts to those who stand for a world united politically, culturally, economically, and educated under a common curriculum. These followers of Baha'u'llah are devoted to the service of a world society, which can be obedient to a world government based upon sound, universal, democratic principles. They labor for a world that is coming to maturity, a world that is dedicated to human progress, in which the law of love has sanction and is vitally active in the lives and social affairs of mankind. And may the day soon arrive when a man may devote his life to the full development of the potentialities with which he has been endowed. We ask it in the name of Moses, in the name of Jesus, in the name of Muhammad, in the name of Buddha, in the name of Baha'u'llah, in the name of all the great world educators since the beginning of time.
John Robart and Hands of the Cause on the Long Obligatory Prayer.
It has come to our attention, friends, that one of the highlights of the convention in Canada was an address made by the beloved Hand of the Cause, John Robarts. I'm happy to announce that John will make that same address to us now for our convention. John?
And now, welcome. Friends, when the Hands of the Cause met during the Baha'i conference last October and November, we were delighted with the progress of the faith throughout the world. But there were some reservations concerning our joy when we considered the home front. You'll remember that our beloved guardian, in his last letter to the American Baha'is, he spoke about the home front. That letter was dated September 21st, 1957. And he said then that if the deficiencies in the home front were not remedied immediately, that the whole plan could be mutilated and the prizes already won jeopardized. And he appealed to us not to let this one remaining opportunity be irretrievably lost. And after some consultation, the Hands decided that I should come to Canada on a 6-month visit. I have had 4 of those months and have loved every minute of them. I have found in visiting the communities in all of Western Canada and Ontario that all the way through in every community we have the most dedicated souls who are devoted to the faith and would give their very life blood for it at any time. I have no doubt this applies all throughout the United States. All these people just dying to serve the cause, but there seemed to be a feeling among many of them that they could not teach. They wanted to teach, but they had been frustrated. They just weren't able to make contacts. They had found that their friends were not interested, and they couldn't keep on trying to persuade them. And I liken this feeling to a sales organization, where if a salesman goes out to sell his product day after day after day and never makes a sale, the time soon comes when he becomes so discouraged and his morale so low that he just cannot go out anymore. It seemed to me that many of the Canadian Baha'is were feeling this way. And when we add to that the fact that Baha'is, as a whole, are not trained salespeople, and they are attempting to sell one of the most difficult products in the world, a religion with a strange name that nobody seems to want, then it is understandable that these Canadian friends should have become discouraged and just not know how to go about selling. So in our consultations throughout Canada, in all these conferences we had in every place, we developed the theory, the idea, that there are two factors that the ordinary sales organization does not have, but that we have. And they are, first, the promised assistance of God to all those who arise to serve him. And the second is the functioning, or the proper functioning, of the local spiritual assemblies. So we took these two factors, which we have in our favor, that the ordinary sales organization does not have, and developed them. And we worked out the fact that, in the first place, it seemed to me that there are many Baha'is who have an intellectual acceptance of the faith, but they don't have it in their hearts in many ways. For instance, we all know that God does assist everyone who arises to serve him. We know it because we read it in the teachings. But I think many don't believe it. In other words, they have it in their head, but they haven't got it in their hearts. And this is where we must get it. We must know that God does assist every one of us when we arise to serve him. Now we also know that throughout Canada and the United States, in every town, village, hamlet, city of the world, there are hundreds and hundreds of waiting souls, people waiting to know about this revelation from God. They are all around us. It is like fruit. When you go to take a fruit off a tree, there is some fruit that is ready to eat now. There's another fruit right near it that will be ready in a week or a month. Today it's hard, but there are some that are ripe and ready now. And there are people waiting in despair for the love of God, and we must reach those people. Those are the ones. Now, we develop the thought that God will guide us right to these people. People who are waiting for us to come to them and bring them the faith of Baha'u'llah. These are the ready, waiting souls. And friends, on this continent, there are millions and millions of them who, as soon as they hear about the faith, they will embrace it. And they will thank God that you brought it to them. We must know this in our hearts, not just in our heads. So on this basis, we went further to develop how do we make sure that we can obtain this assistance of God when we want it, and that He will guide us to these waiting souls. So we spent some time on the thought that in order to obtain this assistance, we must in ourselves develop a greater intensity of devotion to the faith. A real intensity of devotion. And we do this by using the prayers, by studying the Word, and by going out to teach. Now, on the question of prayer, in each one of our sessions, we spent from a half an hour to an hour discussing the long obligatory prayer. It is my feeling that this is one of the most important writings of Baha'u'llah. And it seems there are so many Baha'is who never use it. I wish I had time to spend a half an hour on that prayer alone, because to me this is the key. If we will use this long obligatory prayer often, and many Canadians are now saying it every day, and finding they have tremendous support. Of course, we all know the Tablet of Armagh and many, many other prayers. But we have majored on the use of the long obligatory prayer, suggesting that it be used first thing in the morning. Now, many communities decided that they would do this, that they would use the long obligatory prayer. Several said they were going to use the Tablet of Armagh 9 times a day. They were going to read some of the teachings every morning and every evening. You know, if you have a hose connected to a tap that is running with water, that water is diffused out at the end of the hose. But if the hose is just an inch away from the tap, no water gets into the hose, and the water doesn't diffuse up. It is the same with teaching the cause. If we want to teach, we must be connected with the source of the power. We must be tied right into the teachings and to the love of God. And this we do by developing this infinitely greater intensity of devotion. Now, friends, it is easy to make these statements. There's nothing new about this at all. The only thing new that I have to bring you is a little evidence of the fact that this works. We know the Bab told us this. We know that Baha'u'llah told us this. We know that Abdul Baha told us this. We know that our beloved Shoghi Effendi told us this. Now I want to add the fact that the Canadian Baha'is have also told us this, and I want to give you a little bit of the evidence that they have. Since we've had these meetings, I have had a real deluge of letters from Baha'is all over Canada telling me of their experiences in using these prayers and praying to be guided to the waiting souls and to be guided as to what to say when they got there. So I'm going to read you a few excerpts from some of these letters. I wish I had time. I could read for an hour or 2 hours alone from these letters, but I shall just read a little, perhaps one sentence out of a few letters. And my purpose in doing this is so that you will see that this is working in Canada. And perhaps you don't need this in the United States in the same way. But if you do, it will work here too. Now the first letter, I'm going to read more than an excerpt of it, because it is a particularly beautiful one. It is from a girl, a young girl of about my age. What are you laughing about? She told me the night of our meeting, she said, "John, I have nobody to teach. There isn't one soul. I have no contact. All my friends I've ever had have heard about the faith, and they will not listen anymore. I have no place to go." But she said, "I'm going to try this out. I don't know whether this is right or not, but I'm going to try it. I'm really going to storm the gates of heaven and see if God won't guide me through some waiting souls." Now here is her letter, or here is a part of her letter. "The night after our meeting, I went home and prayed very hard. I used the long obligatory prayer and several others. I had to meet new people and did not know how. Reading a paper the next morning, a small ad announced a 15-week series of drama classes. I immediately applied and was accepted, not knowing what the course entailed. The first evening found me on the floor doing physical exercises. It was a painful procedure for these old bones, but it paid off well. Lying flat on my back, I heard a whisper from a girl, 'That's a fascinating ring you are wearing. Please tell me about it.' In my haste to sit up, I nearly broke every bone in my body. But my face was shining and I was ecstatic. After class that first evening, over coffee, the message was joyfully given to 10 new people. Result? In 3 weeks, a declaration from a wonderful soul, waiting, prepared to give her life and love to the higher law. She is on her knees, thanking God that she can bring her children up the Baha'i way. She has been accepted into the faith at Nowruz. She is moving to a larger house so she can teach. Don't stop reading. There are more surprises. Another student from the same class came to see me 2 nights ago, and after 6 hours of ecstatic and enthusiastic exploration of the teachings, we were on the floor with maps, books, pamphlets spread all around, suddenly said, 'Thank God he sent you to our class. I have been a Baha'i all my life, and I didn't know it.' He instantly declared himself. I was spellbound. I wept. My heart was bursting with exquisite joy and gratitude at the confirmations of the spirit that were being showered upon us in torrents. 2 new believers in 1 month out of a class of 10 is not a bad percentage, don't you think? But that's not all. There's a third, a colored boy who is studying, also the husband of the first friend who won't be far behind. Things are happening fast and furious around these parts. We are all stimulated and encouraged. If this isn't guidance, what is? So I would advise the highest to join a physical exercise class. Be sure to wear their Baha'i rings. Broken bones will bring a new believer in every time." And she ends up, "Isn't this a riot at my age?" Friends, this is just one case. I have several letters like this. And this is happening. Do I need to say any more? Can I sit down now? Well, now here's another, just one paragraph. "I says I can speak for 5 hours. This is a letter, it is a 4-page letter, but I just give you one excerpt from it. From a girl, she and her husband have been in this town in Canada for 7 years. And they haven't brought in any believers, nor have they done any teaching for some years. But they said they certainly were going to do some, and so she wrote a letter telling of her first real experience. And she said, I was sitting along the obligatory prayer about an hour before I was to leave for that meeting, when the strongest conviction came over me that I would tell someone about the faith that evening. I just knew I would. And she did. Another one. The prayers are bringing results for me. Had an amazing talk with my manager today. What a wonderful experience. It almost scares me. In fact, it did scare me. I rushed right upstairs and said the long obligatory prayer. Another one. From a wife whose husband had resisted the cause for some years. And in the same town, there was a wife who had resisted the cause for some years. And she wrote, we had been singing the Tablet of Almighty 9 times every day, along with several other prayers. On March 20th, she wrote again, this was 2 weeks later, to report 2 declarations, her husband and the wife of the other chap. And she said, I am too happy to write a sensible letter, but just had to let you know the good news. And they attribute this to a long spell of prayer, the Tablet of Almighty 9 times a day. Another one, the power of prayer was quite a revelation to me. For I knew that power was there. The tremendous potency of it became clearly shown to me by this happening. The morning after our meeting, she told me later that she had decided she would try this out, and she spent 1 solid hour in prayer. She said, I used the Tablet of Almighty, the long obligatory prayer, the prayer for Canada, other prayers, and within 5 hours, one of my friends quietly asked me to assist her in writing her letter declaring her wish to become a Baha'i. The confirmation of the power and assistance we get from our prayers will live forever with me. Now, here's one that is a little unusual. I must tell you about this one. You see, I am so convinced that this guidance is available, that sometimes I might be accused of perhaps being just a little over-enthusiastic. And I was at one meeting one certain Friday evening, and I turned to one chap who was at the meeting. I knew he was going away for the weekend, so I said, Richard, if you pray, God will bring somebody to your door on Monday afternoon. Now, I didn't mean him to take me too literally on that, but here's his letter. After our meeting, I began to ponder over the words you had said to me. Someone had come to see you on Monday afternoon. I prayed over the weekend more than I have ever prayed before. And on Monday, I waited anxiously and very alert. But nothing happened. I was not despondent as expected. The reason that I must pray with more intensity. Lo and behold, on Tuesday afternoon. Now, friends, I can't hear it right on the nose every time.
Unexpected and wonderful surprise for you. Our beloved man of the cause, Bill Sears, has just arrived.
Tuesday afternoon. You'll never guess what happened. This was another place in Ontario where this chap and his wife had been for several years, and they had no contact. But on Tuesday, it took God a little time to get going on this one. But on Tuesday afternoon, a man came in and his wife, and that started their first fireside, and they came back 2 evenings later. That's just that. Now, another place in Ontario where there had been little teaching and where they were a little skeptical about all this, the fact that if you really prayed with this great intensity of devotion that God would guide you to somebody, this chap wrote a few days later, and he said, a woman telephoned to say that she's one of a group of five who want to study the Baha'i Faith. Frank, can you beat it? Do you think it works? For the first time, this letter goes on, for the first time everybody is both praying and teaching. I have never seen so many happy Baha'is before. Everybody seems to have a new sense of confidence, and the effect is even noticeable in details of personal lives in some of the most wonderful ways. For myself, I just have never seen teaching the faith this way before. Friends, I had a letter from two old friends. One of them saying that his son and his daughter had declared, and another one expressing such joy that his wife had become a Baha'i after many years. And you know, I think this may have been a result of a certain technique that I was able to bring to them from Africa. And I pass this technique on to you in the hope that perhaps you may be able to use it. This is a young African man who has done wonderful teaching in the Nyasaland. His wife had not been a Baha'i. In fact, she was quite hostile to the faith. But at the last convention, he told us that she had become a Baha'i. So after I asked him about her and congratulated him on the fact that his wife had come into the faith and asked how he had done it. Well, he said, you know, it was very difficult at first, but you know, the time came when my wife began to think that she would like to join the meetings, to be a part of the group. You know, he said, we have meetings in our house, 3 nights, 4 nights, sometimes 5 a week. And she thought she'd like to be, you know, come along. He said, we have a very small house. We only have one room, just a little mud hut, and of course, when she wasn't a Baha'i, I couldn't let her stay. I had to ask her to leave the house. And she became a Baha'i during the last rainy season. You know, in Canada, we've had, since I told this story, we've had a deluge of wives coming into the faith. And some husbands have, too. Now, I'm glad to pass this African technique on to you. But I do with a request that you write and tell me how it works when the first time you try it. Now, there are so many other of these letters. One girl writes, I have been saying the tablet of Ahmad 9 times, every day. The main thing is, I find that the people I already know seem to be drawing closer to me, and I feel so much more love for them and for everyone else I meet. Friends, I wonder if I need... Well, here's one other I should read. Here is a dear friend of mine who writes, This is a girl. She said, I don't know that I should read this. I hesitate a little bit. She starts out by saying, Dear John, would you please go back to Africa? You are becoming a disturbing factor in Canada. We can't keep up to those things that are resulting from our prayers. We shall have to stop praying, or we shall become too exhausted to carry on. The things that are happening to us are knocking us all out. This is a small community, and they reported that they have had 5 new Baha'is in 1 week. So I'm going back to Africa just as soon as I can, in the hope that this continues. On the question of the long obligatory prayer, I had one letter of some pages from one chap who wrote most enthusiastically about it, and from his letter I quote this. On the day following my use of the long obligatory prayer, my attitude and actual experience seems to be much different and better than on the days I failed to use it. One might say even there is a qualitative difference in the kind of day I have, and never once has this prayer let me down. Friends, there are so many things we could say, but you all know them anyway, on the importance of this. Now, I think the last letter I shall read from is this one from a girl who had been a Baha'i for several years and had done very little teaching. She said, I have called myself a Baha'i for a long time, but have not been a praying Baha'i. A whole new world has opened up, indescribably more wonderful than that which opened when I first heard about the faith and accepted it intellectually. How shoddy and threadbare that seems now in comparison with this. I praise God for it. A friend, she spoke about a friend who came, the doors opened, and we talked about the faith for 2 hours. He had never heard of it before. He is searching, is full of questions, and is so sincere that I honestly feel ashamed and grateful combined to be alive. That night I prayed in the greatest joy until 3 o'clock. Friends, this is the experience in Canada. Goodness, what's going on here? This is happening everywhere. I've had people telephone me, come to see me, write me many, many letters that I haven't quoted from here, suddenly saying they have come alive. And it is due to the fact that they have begun to use these prayers, and especially the long obligatory prayer. It's a strange thing to me how few people seem to know that prayer. Now, this may not apply in the United States, but in Canada, everywhere. And the reason I developed my respect for it myself was some years ago I visited a community and I came back and reported to a very close Baha'i friend of mine that there were great troubles in this community, great disunity. Well, he said they're not using the long obligatory prayer. Well, I thought this was rather a dogmatic statement. Well, I said, why do you say that? Well, he said, people who use the long obligatory prayer don't have that kind of a problem. So, a year later, I went back to that community, and in the course of our discussions, I gave a little talk on the long obligatory prayer. And some of them said, where do you find that prayer? They haven't been using it, and when they started, a lot of their problems just seemed to dissolve. And then they began to teach. And it seems that in so many communities, where there is active teaching, people are really happy. where they don't teach, they seem to devour one another. It seems that we must, in order to win the crusade goals, and of course we are going to win them, there is no doubt of that, but we need to develop this greater intensity of devotion. I think of Mr. Benani, who was the first hand of the cause in Africa, and one whom Shoghi Effendi loved very much and praised very highly. I remember one time Mr. Benani, who is a man of great humility, a great servant, and has done tremendous work in Africa. He told us that several years before he had been appointed a hand of the cause, he was in Haifa, and Shoghi Effendi pointed to a stone that was lying in front of him, and he said, "Do you know, God could activate that stone so that it could rise up and teach the cause if he wanted to." And Mr. Benani said he couldn't understand why the guardian had said that. But he said, "Now I know." He said, "I am that stone. God has activated me so that I seem somehow to be able to do something for the cause. But literally, I am that stone." Well, that is a great encouragement to me, because I have felt very stone-like myself. And I think many of us have. And it's a wonderful thing to realize that God can activate any one of us if we will just arise to serve the cause. And this applies to all of us. So friends, this is my message. We all want to teach the cause. We all know that there are people waiting all around us, desperately waiting to embrace the cause and the love of God. And if we develop this increased intensity of devotion by using the long obligatory prayer, the Tabitha Dharma, study the teachings, and go out in peace, we will be guided in every step we take. Allah upon. Friends, our cup of joy truly runneth over. We hadn't expected that our beloved hand, Bill Shears, would be here at all for this convention. Often think the heart, I felt we need him too. And so he is here. And I want him to come forward immediately to greet you and to say what is in his heart. No.
Allahu Akbar. I bring you the love and the loving gratitude of your fellow Baha'is in the 21 Latin American republics, and from their two conventions in Central America and the Antilles. Each of the countries has solemnly vowed that they will consolidate their victories, having won their goals, and keep ablaze the fire that you have ignited through your sacrifice of resources and pioneers. I know that what I'd like to say to you from my heart has already been said with love and eloquence by Amitul Baha'u'llah Khanum and by the other hands of the faith. So I'll only share with you this love and repeat the words of the Master. Do you know what day it is in which you are living?
This is a morning for inspiration, friends, and how blessed we are to have four beloved and revered hands of the cause with us, including our own Amitul Baha'u'llah Khanum. Let us hear now from the Roy Isles. Hand of the card.
Well, depends from now upon. I'm very deeply moved this morning, because actually when old age starts to creep on, you start to think of the days of your youth. Of course, I realize that age is a relative thing. My first realization of being getting old was when children were arranging a meeting for the young people in San Francisco. And I became very enthusiastic over it and said, well, we'll do this and we'll do that. And one of my daughters says, but listen, Daddy, this is for the young people. And yesterday as I was sitting here looking at the newly elected National Assembly and your distinguished officers, I thought how wonderful it is to have such fine young people at the helm in America, because the responsibilities devolving upon the American Baha'is during the next few years is going to be tremendous. And to have such a fine, rounded out assembly and such stalwart defenders of the faith is really another of the victories of the cause. But I was particularly moved this morning because it brought back the days when we sat under a tent in this exact spot and Abdu'l Baha laid the cornerstone of the temple. Sophie Lady is smiling to me, she was here. But we're all sitting around on the ground and on the floor just like this. I remember I sat within about 3 or 4 feet of Abdu'l Baha while he was sitting there and the soil was being dug and the cornerstone was being laid. And this came to my mind very vividly this morning as I see this finished building, this glorious edifice, one of the great silent teachers of the cause, and filled with this great throng, devoted and sincere and consecrated Baha'is. I have been very deeply moved in the past few years in traveling around and finding the way the spirit of Baha'u'llah has entered into the lives and impregnated the beings of people everywhere. You have these two distinguished hands of the cause from Africa, which the beloved guardian said would achieve great victories. I remember when the work in Africa first started, the beloved guardian was very enthusiastic. He kept telling us what was going to be accomplished. He told about these great victories. And all my life, I've been engaged in the teaching work, as you all know. I had the privilege of serving on the National Teaching Committee in America for many years, and during all the period of the first 7-year plan. And I said to myself a number of times, I thought, well, I've been chairman of National Teaching Committees. I've watched teaching work, and I've been teaching all my life, and a little afraid the guardian's a little enthusiastic. Of course, I never been bold enough to venture any such thing as that to him, but that was what was in my mind. Then the cable started to be received that these great victories winning, being won. One evening in particular, he was very happy. He'd had some cables, and from my dear brother and a co-worker, the distinguished hand of the call, Moose Banani, telling of these great victories. And he spoke about it in some detail. And then when he got done, he looked at me. He said, you know, when I first started to tell about these great victories, I'm afraid some of you didn't think I knew what I was talking about. The guardian never missed anything, and he knew constantly what was going on. I want to tell you, I don't know whether John shared with you what I think is one of the most interesting stories that came from out of Uganda. And that was the young man, the young Negro, who was very enthusiastic about the cause. He was actually teaching before he was a Baha'i. And the friend said to him, well, why don't you become a Baha'i? Well, he said, after a while. So finally they started to press him again. He said, well, he said, you know, we believe in polygamy down here. And the guardian has ruled that any man who has more than one wife before he becomes a Baha'i can keep all the wives he has. And he says, I'm really in love with a young lady. I want to marry her before I become a Baha'i. I'd only make my third wife, but he said I wanted to do that so that I could have her. On the contrary, I wanted to tell you of an experience that moved Sylvia and myself very much when we were in Swaziland. The Arabs down there have done really tremendous work. They've conquered that country. And the paramount chief is very friendly to the cause. Two of his children are Baha'is. And on the official records of Swaziland, the Baha'i faith is recorded as one of the official religions of the state. And on the ballots and on the registration, when they register to
take the census, it is indicated the different religions, and it's Baha'i is printed down as one of the religions, showing that it's been officially recognized and accepted by the state as one of the official religions. Well, those favorite daughters, the Princess Kanami, very remarkable young lady, beautiful girl, and while at the island, she and they invited her to come spend the weekend. So we had many hours together, talked and visited and discussed the cause. And those of you who know Africa know the condition of the women there. And what moved her so much is one day she said, I have been reading the Dawnbreakers. She said, I want to become the Karam Lion of Swaziland. And then I'm also thinking of the Intercontinental Conference, which we had in Jakarta and Singapore, meeting those native peoples in those areas. These native people from the Indonesian islands, from the Hawaii Islands, where Dr. Mahajer has done such tremendous work and is now, a few years ago, there were no Baha'is. I think I mentioned this now, there are some 6,000 Baha'is. Some of those were present at this, what was to be the conference in Jakarta. But we had a chance to meet with all of them and talk with them. And we showed them the portrait of Baha'u'llah. Such reverence, such respect, such devotion. And then when we had to move the conference to Singapore, the Malayan natives were there. And this was a really a moving experience, friends, because it was the first time when the great bulk of those present in the conference were of the brown race. And the guardian was very happy and very enthusiastic about this because we'd had the 4 acres in the faith that we had not had up to that time and the members of the brown race. Near the preponderance of the people in the audience and making up the conclave were the brown race. And then we knew truly that that being the last of the Intercontinental Conferences, that was certainly the basis on which the world government should be called, could be called, because it covered the earth and there were members of every race present. Well, there was one young lad about 22, 23 years old. Fine character. He told of the difficulties of his youth. He came from a Catholic family. And he attended an Episcopalian church. An Episcopalian school. And in the school, they keep after him all the time. They say, look, if you come here for your education, why don't you accept our religion? And then he would go to church with his parents. His parents would press him, and the priest would press him and say, look, if you're a Catholic, why don't you go to a Catholic school? So his life was quite miserable and torn between these conflicting religious interests, all of them in the name of Christ. And then he became a Baha'i. And his parents became so infuriated that they disowned him and put him out. And he'd had a very difficult time. And he reported, he told of his experiences. And he says, I have been reading the Dawnbreakers. It's interesting what the Dawnbreakers have done for people. There's an iron recall when the Bab told Hujjat, you will be the first martyr in Persia. He says, I am praying that I will be the first martyr in Malaya. Friends, this is a devotion, a purity of heart, and a devotion that moves you. And anyone who has the idea that the cause is not strongly entrenched in these new countries and in these new areas, I want to say the pillars of the faith are being raised up day unto day. Look at the Galinda. Look at these Baha'is of South Africa, like Rudolf O'Donnell and Mafeking. No matter what happens in the world, those people will be teaching this cause. And I'm moved to say that I only wish I could find in the old established centers of the faith, as we go around, as I mentioned the other day, in America, Canada, Germany, India, Egypt, these areas where the cause has been established so long, I only wish we could find evidences of a spirit of devotion such as these people manifest, and as these people carry into their lives. These people have been in jail. Rudolf O'Donnell has been in jail 3 times. And at the 3rd time, the hearing he was finally given a permit to teach as a Baha'i teacher throughout all of Mozambique. And one of the most difficult countries in the world we have is Portugal. And Mozambique belongs to Portugal. It's a very Catholic country. But it shows how suffering in the cause has done so much.
Perhaps one of our troubles here in all these old established centers is we don't suffer enough. You, I thought, and Mr. Sabat so beautifully portrayed to you the problems in Persia. But you, I thought he might mention that there never has been, since the early days of the course, so much teaching work going on as there is today in Persia. So many new people coming into the cause, not since the early days of the cause. And the National Assembly attributes this to the persecutions which they had 2 or 3 years ago. The outsiders want to know who are these people that were persecuted. And it gives them an opportunity to teach, and to teach continuously. This mic is a little too low. I mentioned to you briefly the other day how distressed the Guardian was and how sad when we first arrived in Israel, the Holy Land, and how as this crusade developed, it became happy, became enthusiastic. Different ones who made pilgrimages in the earlier days and then came to see the Guardian and said, I just can't believe it's the same human temple. Because he's so vigorous, so enthusiastic. And all of it depended upon the word that came from different parts of the world. If he received messages of successes in the cause, he was enthusiastic and happy. If he received bad news, then he was distressed. And his distress was very, very deep. And he was weighing constantly, friends, the conditions all over the world. I recall one time he said, I am so busy, I don't have time to actually act as the guardian. People write me letters, and they ask questions, and they've all been answered, and they're in the books, and they've been published, and yet they write and ask me these questions. Pilgrims would come and sit down at the table opposite the guardian, and I'd ask if they could ask a question, say yes. And they'd ask a question, say, but look at that, it was published in the American Baha'i News just 3 months ago, the answer to this question. And these were things of this nature that kept the guardian pressed down. He said, I am so busy that I do not have the time to carry on the creative work which is necessary for the guardian of the cause. He said, I have to consider the health of the Baha'i world. I have to consider the health of every country and every nation. I have to consider what I can do to stimulate the Baha'is so they can carry forward and win these great victories. I have to consider what is the next step in these crusades to be taken, because that is my work. And those are the things that I should be engaged in doing. As I say, the activities of the friends consisted, made up his health or his illness. It was an odd thing. We'd wake up in the morning and everything would be wrong, be gloomy. And suddenly we'd find that the guardian was not well. Or we'd wake up and it'd be storming out and raining, but everybody was happy and enthusiastic. Then we'd find out that the guardian was well and had received some wonderful news somewhere and was very joyous and happy. His whole spirit dominated everything. One evening he was talking about this question of the fact that in the old established centers of the cause, the faith seemed to have lost its stimulus, seemed to have lost its dynamic. It was not moving forward the way it should. And he was asked, what is the reason, Shoghi Effendi, for this condition? And the beloved guardian made this reply, which I'm going to share with you, because to me it is very significant. He said, the condition of the cause is affected by two things. One, it's affected by the condition of the world at large. That in all these established centers, they are civilized. They have all the facilities of human comfort. They're distracted. They have radio. They have television. They have all of these things, and they don't know what to do. They're seeped in a sea of materialism, and that materialism is engulfing the whole cause. It's the second of the Baha'is themselves. The Baha'is are not properly consecrated in the cause. They are Baha'is through the mind and not through the heart. They understand the cause, but they don't live the cause. And where the living is done, the degree to which they're moving forward, unfortunately, they are involved in this vortex of materialism in which they live. And they have not been able to orient itself to the Baha'i way of life rather than to the way of life in which
they live in the outer world. This is a very subtle and important point, friends, that if even to the degree that we consecrate ourselves and serve in the cause, we should be sure and do it according to standards of teachings and not the standards of the civilization in which we live. This is most important. Because if we simply take an act as a renaissance within that civilization, we've accomplished nothing. But if we set up the Baha'i way of life, that is the source of salvation. And if you please, that is the kingdom of God on earth. And that is the thing I'm afraid we're all short of. We're short of it in every one of the established communities that have come under the influence of the materialistic development.